true. It has everything to do with enforcing global standards down to the local school level. It also says that global classrooms helps students develop the knowledge of the content standards through the activities that they engage in. And global classrooms, in fact, this particular unit says it focuses on 6 of the 21 issues of sustainable development outlined in Agenda 21. Agenda 21, local classrooms, one road. And of course, Mike Kaufman talked about Agenda 21 in the chapters, so I'm not going to go through those to save a little time, except to show that Chapter 36 is about education, public awareness, and training. You want to read the curriculum standards? You can also read it right out of Agenda 21. That is the curriculum standards. Things like changing consumption patterns, planning and management of land resources, global action, strengthening the role of non-government organizations. All of these chapter titles is the curriculum. These are the standards aligned from the global down to the local. In fact, in the Model UN, it says that the global focuses on Agenda 21. It's the standards that align. So that was just making that point again. It also compares the National Center for the National Council of Social Studies national standards with the global classroom curriculum and shows how their standards are answered by the global classroom. We've heard so much about this. It's all the same stuff. I'm not going to read all of these. So go to the United Nations Association of the USA, and you can read all about it. On their website, they had posted for a while a comment that through global classrooms, students have been able to unplug themselves from the Americentric view and be empathetic with another country's view, even if they don't agree with it. That's indoctrination at its finest. I hold these ideas even if I don't agree with it. Like I said, they have State Department sponsorship, and Hillary Clinton spoke on their May 9th Model UN Summit in Washington, D.C., where all the finest students of the future leaders of the global government met. She said things like, this is kind of fun, the best scientific evidence about global warming comes from the Intergovernmental Panel. Did we lose a signal here? How long has that been out? Oh, there it is. There are so many issues that you know about in your studies leading up to them being part of the Model UN. In other words, she's admitting, even in this comment, that all the evidence for global warming comes from this one place. And that's absolutely true, as you heard from Dr. Michael Kaufman. She also goes on, this is a little cryptic. I only put this in here because I can't quite figure it out. She says, and the U.S. supports the UN because we think it's an investment in our own security. Now listen to this statement. The State Department is partnering with the military and hoping to really make clear that our partnership means that the civilian side of our efforts have to be run by the State Department. You know, Hillary has a way of saying things that she probably shouldn't. But exposing some of the truth herself. And this is one of those statements that I think fits into that. Now, with the new standards has to come new forms of testing. We no longer test, have you noticed, we now assess. Why is that? Because testing is a measure of objective knowledge. An assessment is a measure of value. We put an assessment on our property to determine its value for tax purposes. We are now assessing our children to determine their value to this future new society. Now, the NAEP defends itself saying, oh, no, the nation's report card is a test of knowledge and skills, not of behavior or convictions. Listen to the very next statement. The test exercises will deal strictly with students' knowledge of civic dispositions. Let's define civic dispositions. They do that for us. Civic dispositions refers to the inclinations or habits of the heart needed to assume one's personal, political, economic responsibility in an informed, thoughtful, and effective manner. Folks, knowledge now means civic dispositions. How you view things, how your inclinations of the heart affect your values, attitudes, and beliefs. I mean, they've just admitted it in the paperwork for the national report cards. It goes on to tell us the National Assessment Governing Board's policy mandates, again, that the content of the NAEP reflect voluntary national standards. There we have it again. Voluntary now means mandatory. If you mandate something that's voluntary, it's mandatory. There's no question about it, right? Well, let's look at President Obama's plan to change, continue, the national performance assessments. He says this is not about the kind of testing that is mushroomed under No Child Left Behind. No, it's exactly like it. It's about developing thoughtful assessments that lead to better results. Outcome-based education, in other words. He says America will not succeed unless every child is performing. So he's talking about performance assessments as well. Now, this is a research paper out of Achieve Inc. meant for Minnesota when we were trying to pass the national or the state assessments, but it's a national research paper that defines performance assessments by saying it's a closer measure of our children's ability to achieve the aspirations we hold for them than our conventional forms of standardized testing. It goes on to say, performance assessment is aimed at moving away from testing practices that require students to select a single correct answer to a practice that requires students to create evidence through performance that will enable assessors to make valid judgment about what they know and can do in situations that matter. Now, how's that for fuzzy math? Have you read the standards for fuzzy math, by the way? Standard 4 says children must learn that mathematics solutions or mathematics is man-made, that solutions are arbitrary, and that they are determined by consensus. I mean, mathematics is the last subject to fall under the postmodern knife, literally. But this is what the assessments are. It's all fuzzy stuff so that assessors can make valid judgments about our children's value in this future brave new world. Assessing dispositions, what democracy means to ninth graders, since No Child Left Behind made it a federal offense to show you the test, we can only show you the results. This is the answers that kids gave for government-related responsibilities in economics. For instance, now 84.2% of ninth graders believe that it's government's responsibility to set prices. The curriculum's been working quite well. Our ninth graders are now moving up on that global scale you hear so much about. 58.6% believe it's government's responsibility to provide an adequate standard of living for the unemployed. This is how they're answering these questions on the nation's report card. Reducing differences in income and wealth among people, the redistribution of wealth, 63.5% of ninth graders now believe that is government's responsibility. The curriculum is working the way it was designed to work. Do you wonder why people elect a President Obama who promises these things? They've been trained to. Now, the mandatory voluntary national standards are aligned to the mandatory voluntary assessments. Standard 16 says that students will understand that there is an economic role for government to play in a market economy. Notice it does not say anything about free market economy. China has a market economy. Governments often define, then protect, property rights. Most government policies also redistribute income. This is what our children are learning because it is the global, national, local standards in every school in America, USA, at least in the 46 states Obama bragged about. It came from the National Council on Economic Education, connected to an international program by the cover's own admission. Well, Earth Summit requires these things. I'm not going to read this. Yeah, I'm going to. Both formal and non-formal education are indispensable to changing people's attitudes so that they have the capacity to address their sustainable development concerns. Ethical awareness, environmental values and attitudes, skills, behavior. I mean, you know, on the world level, they don't mind just saying it like it is. We have to kind of hide things from the American public in our publications. On the website, it also says, indeed, in the 21st century, the literacy of sustainable development will be as essential to comprehending the world as were the traditional skills of reading and writing at the start of the 20th century. The deliberate dumbing down of America? Yeah. Caution, literacy now means proper attitude for sustainable development. They've redefined the terms. Knowledge no longer is a primary purpose. Now, you can go to this ESD toolkit and get the Education for Sustainable Development toolkit written out of the University of Tennessee, by the way, through a U.S. Department of Education grant. Actually, it was a different grant managed by the U.S. Department of Education, so they even hid their name in this original report. They tell us that generally more highly educated people who have higher incomes consume more resources than poorly educated people who tend to have lower incomes. In this case, more education increases the threat to sustainable development. I close my case. Is this not a deliberate dumbing down of America for the purpose of sustaining the planet? Absolutely. What do high standards mean then? World citizenship encompasses the constellations of principles, values, attitudes, and behaviors that the people of the world must embrace if sustainable development is to be realized. This is now high international standards. And of course, Oklahoma now has their curriculum, Globalizing Oklahoma's K-16 curriculum. I got to speak in Tulsa and at Paul Blair's Reclaiming Oklahoma for Christ conferences every year. If you haven't looked those places up, get connected and get there and start connect with the people that are fighting this and exposing some of this stuff. But I did a full presentation on the whole Oklahoma system to the Oklahoma Education Senate Committee here about 3 years ago, was it? I can't remember. Well, there's a second part of this. I'm not going to play this clip. I'm going to go to the next one. There's a second part of this, Education for Sustainable Economic Development. Now, Goals 2000, what I gave you was the content problem. This is now the structural problem of education. Only two problems, content and structure. The long-term objective includes national development plans, an investment in human capital with special policies and programs directed at children. Countries should strengthen practical training programs for graduates from vocational schools, high schools, to enable them to meet labor market requirements and to achieve sustainable livelihoods. Now, that's a mouthful. I'll let Shirley explain it to you.
During the past 10 years, we've been going through a reform movement. And that reform movement began with the governors of the nation, and basically what their concern was that they began to understand the very close relationship between economic development and human capital.
Okay, that's enough. Basically, my point is here, they knew about this in 89. This is where it started. Now, follow that up with the Carnegie Foundation on Education, who sponsored Mark Tucker's organization in 86, the National Center on Education and Economy. He explained, by the way, Hillary Clinton was on his board prior to her becoming president under her husband. Huh? It was kind of a joke. They called it a school-to-work transition system, where extensive occupational preparation programs combining general education with worksite training provide foreign employers with highly skilled work-ready youth. He said that in most countries we studied, schools begin to prepare young people for working life early. Students in Denmark, Germany, and Sweden begin learning about occupations in the seventh grade from local employers and labor market representatives. And to prepare them for working life. In Germany, young people enter one of 380 formal apprenticeship programs and receive training in a company 4 days a week. Now, he's describing something that some of you probably recognize as the big push under Clinton called School to Work. But listen to this quote in the book. The problem with the United States is that there are too many people in college and not enough qualified workers. Now, we keep hearing about the push to get more and more kids in college. Did anybody know about the post-secondary education option, where you can get your kids out of 2 years of high school and start college early? Basically, that's the model. That and 2 years of apprenticeship training is the model for the new 4-year degree in education. Our community colleges are going to become the universities, preparing us for this labor market. Now, I'm going to prove that in a couple of ways. Let's just skip this one. This just talks about how the funding came about. Well, I'm going to mention this one. This was just some of the funding conferences on this system from about 8 years ago. Notice the price of this conference of attending. $10,000 per participant with a minimum enrollment of 50. $10,000 to attend a conference. If Tom had charged $10,000, how many of you would be here? I mean, even if you wanted to be and could afford it, would you do it? Who goes to these kind of things? Government goes to these kind of things, and this is how they transfer tax dollars to these NGOs to fund them to shape the wind's directions so that when our politicians put their wetting fingers in the air, they know which way to blow. That's what this is about. This is taxation without representation. This is about taking your money to sell you ideas that you disagree with. That's what this is. That's how they transfer the funds into the NGOs to work against us. Here's how it happened here. We talked about public-private partnerships a little bit. Now, this is a public-private partnership on a big scale between government, education, and the economy. The first piece was put together by the contract of Goals 2000. Now, Goals 2000 isn't really a set of goals. It's a mandate. This created what we've talked about, this kind of thing where government now controls education through the Great Society bills. The second piece was school to work. That created the partnership between education and the economy and turned our schools into job training centers at taxpayer expense. Why were businesses behind it? Because they were spending billions on the job training. If we can get the taxpayers to pay that, that frees up money for them. So it's a second piece of the puzzle. The third piece most people don't know about is the Workforce Investment Act. How many have ever heard of this? This is the management mechanism of the whole thing. And you know it's all controlled by the 800-pound gorilla at the top. The purpose of the other partners is to feed the gorilla. So, and they're all part of the same plan. They were broken up in pieces and passed piecemeal at state level in order to build the puzzle picture on the box. You know, our legislatures didn't know what the heck they were passing because they only had the piece. It was reassembled at the state level. No Child Left Behind came in and held all the states accountable to the contracts. Okay, so what this looks like at the school level is preparing for economic development. This is a document right out of the state of Minnesota where education reform, workforce preparation, and economic development are all merged as one unit. Now, I spoke on a panel at the Council on National Policy with Congressman Tom Tancredo, and he spent his entire time when I explained this system saying this is exactly what they're putting in place. And he said they even merged the education department with the workforce preparation departments at the committees at the federal level. What this is about education keyed to one's ultimate life goal or life and work goal. How do you do that starting in grade school? Because that's where this starts, grade school. School to work, they called it a whole new approach, a revolution that would change the face of education. Well, it didn't work so well for a number of reasons, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. State work, how am I doing time-wise here? I think I've been going about 40 minutes, 30 minutes. Good, Sue? Okay. The state workforce investment boards were mandated by the Workforce Investment Act. Now, these workforce investment boards are in all states. Oklahoma has one. Minnesota has one. Their composition are representatives appointed. Now, talk about your doublespeak. Is that possible to have a representative of business appointed by the governor? Is it possible to have a representative of parents appointed by the government? No, those groups don't get to elect their own representation. This is a Soviet system, as Mike Shaw talks about. This is not freedom. So these boards are put together in order to control the entire thing. Now, Oklahoma couldn't even get it done through the legislators, so they did it through an executive order to create their Workforce and Economic Development, established under authority of Executive Order 2005-27. So here in Oklahoma, it was actually an executive order that built this structure. And the bill even talks about it being mandated by the Workforce Investment Act, which isn't an act or a bill. It was a contract that the governor signed. The purpose of the council is to guide the development of a comprehensive and coordinated workforce development system for the state, and review and make recommendations that will align the workforce system, including education, with economic development goals of the state. And integrate shall provide Oklahoma a competitive advantage in a global economy. I mean, all the rhetoric is here in your own bill. There are also appointed members to represent different groups. And the Oklahoma 2006, now I pick on Oklahoma just because I'm here. I mean, it's the same in every state, okay? They say the Governor's Workforce Council and Economic Development is developing a collaborative framework for connecting and identifying career pathways. That's career tracking, folks. They go on to say that the formation, it just brings together, here, this is one I want to read. The Governor's Council for Workforce and Education Development completed an employer education needs and satisfaction inventory to identify employer needs for particular skills and to identify gaps between employee supply and employer demand. This, friends, is the new meaning of supply and demand economics. This is how they're using our own words against us. They redefine the term so you think you're voting in favor of supply and demand economics. In Minnesota, they were a little more blatant. Based on federal and state research on where job growth is anticipated, St. Paul Secondary Schools will consider 6 career clusters as the focus of their smaller learning environments. In other words, we will retrofit the schools to plan their training for what the local employer force needs. This is menial labor. In fact, here's an example out of the same blueprint. There's a high school girl working at work-based learning, getting experience in the media arts at a Walgreens photo department. Isn't it nice, though, to think her parents are probably home? My daughter is in the media arts. She's pushing buttons at a Walgreens. I mean, talk about training for unemployment with old technology. I mean, this is the problem with planned economies. I mean, if these people could see into the future this far, they'd be brokers, for crying out loud. You know, not retrofitting my children to meet what they think the economy and the future jobs are going to hold. In Minnesota, it's the same thing, supply and demand. The bottom line here as a statewide indicator of how well it's doing is a sustainable family income. Have we managed to reach sustainable levels of family income? Now keep in mind, this is what we're assessing our children to believe if this is government's responsibility and this is mandated by Agenda 21. Meet the labor market requirements and to achieve sustainable livelihoods. So it is embedded, it's in place. Now, it didn't gain legs very much because George Bush did pull us out of a very few important pieces. He did manage to stop a couple of things that he just wasn't quite too sure about. It's going to be redoubled the effort under President Obama. Now, this is his executive summary, of preparing workers of today for the jobs of tomorrow. This came out last month. He tells us, here's the soundbite. A well-trained and highly skilled workers will be best positioned to secure high-wage jobs. This is nothing more than Mark Tucker's rhetoric. Same thing. Right? He could have been reading the book from Mark Tucker. He goes on to say, the President's Council of Economic Advisors presents a projection of potential developments in the U.S. labor market and discusses the preparations necessary to develop the 21st century workforce. This is nothing but the book out of the National Center on Education and Economy 10 years ago, A Labor Market System for the 21st Century. This is why I'm bringing up all these old documents, because this is the future plan. And you won't understand the soundbite rhetoric of the president if you don't understand what the plan is. It's been written for years. No Child Left Behind renamed career clusters as smaller learning communities. He's bringing it out as career pathways. He says career pathways or career clusters, he actually used both terms, programs can begin as early as middle school and can include accelerated programs that blend basic skills and occupational training. Now, what about the future jobs? Okay, it's another book right out of the National Center on Education Economy, Hillary and Mark Tucker's old organization. His plan to keep the system continues with a projection of where job growth is. Note the stats he gives us. 52% of growth through 2016 will be environmental-related occupations. All other occupations, 14% growth. What is he banking on? What is he investing his money in? His plan. What is he investing our children's future careers on? His plan. Folks, this is nothing more than a totally planned economy, right down to our children's futures. Now, this system has been tried before. This is the original report out of HUD from the official team that went to study the USSR's education system. Now, I'm going to give you both barrels here, folks, because you got to know where this is coming from. All right? The Soviets called it polytechnical education and said production needs play an important role in designing of the curriculum to meet the practical requirements of the state's economy. Sound familiar? It's the exact same words as the school-to-work plan. Reposition workforce programs as part of a mainstream pipeline for producing skilled workers to meet the needs of the state economy. It's the exact same words Barack Obama gave us last month. I almost fell out my chair when I saw that. The education system was broken down into lifelong learning. Okay. Anybody ever hear that term? Cradle to career?
Okay.
Technicums,
question.
Career academies, what we're turning our schools into.
Wait a minute. Yes,
unified curriculum.
How do
we
I
call
sound?
It integrated curriculum.
You aren't going to know how I sound.
Now, this is the chart out of the Soviet team's report from 1958. Skill certificates and portfolios. All our kids are doing now is portfolios. Have you noticed that? There's a plan to merge the portfolio with the state-defined resume. We'll follow a child for life. You know what that sounds like to me? Your papers are not in order. That's what it sounds like to me. Targeted industries, local regional workforce boards, on-site work-based learning. I could go 2 hours through the Chinese system and show you page for page how it's identical to the U.S. plan. Now, The Changing Man, one of the books I studied in was a 1937, Changing Man, Principles of Communist Education, said the planned economy brings us to the very close connection so apparent in the USSR between education, economics, and politics. It is impossible to separate these three. Do you recognize the partnership we're building? The very close connection between government, education, and economy. It's impossible to separate these three. We are building the Soviet system piece by piece, and it's almost complete. The conclusion of the 1958 report was one of the leading Soviet educators told us, "We believe in a planned society, you in individual initiative. Let time tell." Folks, the Soviet Union has failed. Time has told us. So why are we rebuilding the system that failed in the Soviet Union? That's what I want to ask my president. Why are we rebuilding what has proven failed time and time again wherever it's been tried? Freedom is the only thing that works. Lay down a broad-based liberal academic arts education so our children are prepared for whatever the future holds. Don't presume to tell me that you know the future 20, 30 years down the road. That makes me angry because we have lost our freedom and lost the system that created it. Now, how did it come back? I got to tell you this. Robert Beck out of the University of Minnesota published under a $4 million grant, a revisiting of the Soviet system. 42 pages. I wish somebody would pay me $4 million to write 42 pages. Listen to what he has to say. Soviet polytechnical education is rooted in Marxist-Leninist ideology. This is a U.S. Department of Education report. Refined from Marxist writing, polytechnicism means, in brief, combining teaching and learning with practical work experience. The aim of polytechnical education is to prepare youth for a life of productive labor in society and contribution to the construction of communism. It concludes, relating vocational to academic programs in American high schools is a challenge. This essay is a step toward that end. That this should be carefully monitored for possible adaptation in American public education is not a far-fetched idea. A friendly ideology had helped the Soviet Union. We shall have to succeed without that aid, and this is the challenge to us. This was written in 1990, prior to Goals 2000. They're successful. The ideology is embedded in our national standards. It's been embedded in our curriculum. The new international principles of civics, by the way, civic education under Charles Quigley out of Berkeley, now at UCLA, holds the contract for the National Standards in Civics, the National Model Curriculum, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. They alone hold the contract. On their website, they have an article, Preparing Students for the 21st Century Mission of Schools is, in the past century, the civic mission of schools was education for democracy in a sovereign state. In this century, by contrast, education will become everywhere more global and international. And we ought to improve our curricular frameworks and standards for a world transformed by globally accepted and internationally transcendent principles. It's over. We lost the battle for education. Now they're after the other establishment areas. 20 million children have taken this curriculum already to date. 20 million children have been through this program. She tells us, or the book itself tells us in the beginning, the primary purpose of this textbook is not to fill your head with a lot of facts about American history and government. It's not. It's about transformation. It's about tearing down what our founders built. Listen to this phrase. As fundamental and lasting as its guarantees have been.
Time in bed.
Okay, there it is. All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, popping into a program that is three-quarters of the way done with. Hope you're enjoying today's presentation. It might have been kind of confusing to our radio affiliates out there. I don't know if Chris bothered to take commercial breaks, but okay. Well, that's okay, too, but we got to look out for our affiliates out there. But at any rate, down here at the are up here from Texas at the Freedom 21 10th Annual National Conference. And, well, who do I see sitting over here in a chair? It looks like it's Michael Badnarik, which is calling Chris into the network right now. So one ringy-dingy, two ringy-dingies. Folks, I hope you take advantage of the free streaming that's going on at republicbroadcasting.org. If you take a look at the top of the page, Chris took off my Freedom 21 banner, but if you look up there at the blue letters, this conference is available to people via the streaming. Just click it on, and you can hear what's taking part down here in Oklahoma City. And it's very, very encouraging. There's a great crowd here, bigger than it was last year. Gee, I wonder why that is. A lot of tyranny going on out there. As you've been paying attention to the town hall meetings that the Congress critters, the creeps, let's call them, senators and congressmen alike. You know, I don't know why they're still televising this, because the people are saying such terms that people have not heard in years. Constitution, illegal, are you people socialist? And this is going out over airwaves across the country. I do not know what they're doing, except to maybe cause a little bit of political turmoil. And it's rather fascinating to me that they'd even be doing this. Now, we're down here, as I said, at the Freedom 21 conference. And today, I'm moderating this along with Amanda Tiergarten. And I've got Michael. And along with Tom DeWeese, the keynote speaker. He was the first one off this afternoon. It was none other than G. Edward Griffin, followed by Mike Shaw, Dr. Michael Kaufman, Alan Quist, professor, political science, Michael Chapman. We're going to go to dinner here in about 25 minutes. The timing on that couldn't have been more perfect. But we're just having a ball down here. Michael, do I have Chris? Am I connected here?
I think so.
There he is. Who do I see at the end of the hallway? Mr. Badnarik. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad to be here at Freedom 21. This is my first Freedom 21 conference. I didn't know that I was going to be here until about 36 hours ago. But there's a lot of big names here speaking at the conference.
Well, and you and I were just talking before we cut in here to the broadcast, and you had moved from Austin up to Dallas, Texas, and I'd ask you, so you all settled in there, and you said, well, I collect my mail there. I might have slept there maybe 7 days, but you've been on the road. What have you been doing? What have you been up to?
Sometime in June, I traveled with my buddy Rob. We went from Dallas to Chicago to Ohio to Niagara Falls to Philadelphia. And I spent some time, about a week in Philadelphia. I taught my Constitution class there. I participated in the 4th of July parade in Philadelphia, rode on the Campaign for Liberty float, gave two presentations in the Independence Hall, and then participated in a debate the following day on anarchy versus minarchy. And then we drove the motorhome from Philadelphia to Vegas in 4 days to spend another 5 days at Freedom Fest in Vegas. And after that, I flew to Anchorage, Alaska, to teach my Constitution class there for the my first visit to Alaska, and have been basically traveling around the country telling people about the Constitution.
Constitution, let me see, not to be confused with the word constipation. You know, the last time that on a public forum, Mr. Badnarik, I think it was Ron Paul. Wasn't he running for a little office called the presidency? He was the one that started to reintroduce people to that foreign-sounding name, Constitution. And what I've been seeing, and I wanted to get your opinion on this because you've rubbed elbows with a few politicians. And they don't like the word constitution because they're busy trying to circumvent it. But what I wanted to get your opinion on these town hall meetings that have been going on. This has not been going well for them, but why is the national media playing these things? Because people are saying such things as you people are illegal, you're unconstitutional, you're all socialists. What benefit is this to them?
I don't know. It's really hard. And most of what our government does is fraudulent and, you know, kind of underhanded. And I can't decide if people are waking up, they're starting to feel the financial pinch with the $1 trillion bailout last year and the double $1 trillion stimulus package they've been talking about this year. If people are genuinely starting to wake up and participate in these Tea Party rallies, and if Americans are becoming disgusted with the status quo, I certainly hope that's the truth. I think that a lot of that effort may be kind of redirected. We may have some controlled opposition that people are allowing people to vent and say some of these things, which are certainly true, but to kind of bleed off the momentum. And I hope that that is not a primary or a large percentage of what's going on.
Well, I, down here at this conference, I met a gentleman that I have not seen in 11 years, and he was coordinating the campaign for Ron Paul up in Michigan. And there were some problems that took place. He was replaced for the Ron Paul campaign for president last year up in Michigan, only to find out a couple of weeks ago they discovered that George Soros was pumping money into the opposition to blow the Ron Paul campaign apart in Michigan. These kind of political theatrics is nothing new, but the general public never knows about them, and the ne'er-do-wells never like to be caught on this deal. But this is kind of status quo in politics today in America. The people in this country, Mike, they don't have a ghost chance. They are set against the machine. We're out there. We're trying to get people elected that will represent the people under the law and the Constitution. And it seems to be thwarted at any given turn. When I was down here just a couple hours ago, I've been talking to I was talking to Oklahoma Senator Randy Brogdon, and I told him, I said, look, I've been playing around with an idea. Now, we've seen these town hall meetings that are absolutely blowing up in the face of the ne'er-do-wells coming out of Washington, D.C., trying to sell the Obamacare plan. But I've been talking to these guys down here, and I wanted to see if they were interested in doing programming on a commercial-free satellite network and calling it the Elected Representative Network, ERN. I discovered, I was down here talking to people that came in from Arkansas all over the country to this Freedom 21 conference. I said, hey, you're from Arkansas. Do you have any good people that would be interested? They told me that we don't have anybody in Arkansas that we would consider a statesman to even consider putting them on a network such as that. And I was astounded. Michael, this is America. Where is the grassroots movement out here? Where are the people that know the difference between a politician and a statesman? And why is Arkansas devoid of anybody that's really representing the people?
Well, it's been years and decades of basically mind control. Not mind control, but the general idea that the government is going to, you know, do things for you. People have gotten politically lazy. They don't know where their electricity comes from. You know, they flip the switch, and if the lights don't turn on, they're totally baffled. And people have are really not in touch with their own survival. And as we get into this the economic depression that is rapidly approaching, more and more people are already out of work. More and more people are going to be doing things for themselves, growing their own food. And, you know, in addition to their physical survival, their political survival is going to become more and more important to them. And I think that's where the motivation for these tea parties is coming from. there are so many Patriot websites now that literally the amount of information coming in through email from various people is just kind of overwhelming. And I think that eventually the average American is going to realize that the government that we currently have is not the one that the founding fathers intended. Now, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we are certainly hoping that things change for the better, and I think they will as, you know, people's comfort level is stretched.
And that's pretty sad state of affairs, Michael. I mean, if people are so apathetic, and I'm trying to get out of the conference room here, walking around with my computer, but if people are so politically apathetic and they don't know what's happening and how to stop it, and that's reflected, we don't have any state representation for the people in the state of Arkansas. This has got to be going on other places. Michael, your honest opinion here, are we going to be able to do anything in this country politically to get this back on its constitutional basis?
Oh, yes. The first thing I'd like to say is that I am convinced that we will restore liberty. Now, I don't know how torturous the path is going to be between now and then. I don't think that we'll be able to do it completely passively. I think that the American people are going to need to be shocked, you know, by some government outrage, you know, another Waco, Texas, or, you know, possibly, you know, beginning to round people up and put them into FEMA concentration camps. Something will trigger the general public outrage, and then hopefully we will have people like yourself, you know, explaining how things are supposed to be, and that we will have true leaders emerge to lead us back towards liberty. I don't know how long that's going to take, but I know that we will eventually be there. It's, you know, winter is, you know, one of the most harsh of the seasons, and it always seems to be worse right at the end. Because, you know, it's gone on for so long. But eventually, you know, spring and summer do return. And I think that there's this political cycle where people establish liberty and then they get complacent. And, you know, when things get bad enough, they will, you know, rise up again and reestablish liberty. And I think that we are at that point. It may seem very, very bleak right now, but I think that's what it's going to take to motivate some people to become active.
Well, they seem primed for it because, as I brought this up earlier before, Michael, the people seem to want to change. We had indications with this when we saw Ron Paul run for president. He awakened that sleeping giant up there, at least politically, and the passions of people out here that saw what was going on economically in this country, politically, socially, they weren't happy, but they didn't have a conduit in which to not only just, and we're not here just to funnel our frustrations and talk about, you know, things that are going wrong. We're here to talk about solutions, because this is my greatest fear, Michael. I mean, it's still relatively calm and normal. You and I are standing in this hotel, the Sheraton Hotel right now down in Oklahoma City, having this wonderful conversation about possibilities and you know, good things to happen into the future. But what I am afraid of, and I've seen the militarization of our police in this country. The big topic nowadays is the swine flu. Are they going to declare martial law? Is this going to be forced vaccinations? Is this going to happen if Obama, by executive order, one day decides that, well, he's going to ban guns because all these shootings are going on? I'm afraid this might come down to a shooting war, but more importantly, it might be agent provocateured into a situation like that and to bring about chaos, which is going to shut everything down. It's going to shut radio broadcast down. It will shut everything off in this country, internet, everything. Everything is going to go silent. And that's what I'm more afraid of, because, as you said, there are people that are starting to come around. They're starting to become active. They're starting to become vocal. And it's important that we be able to maintain this Do you see the possibility? Here's the question. Do you see this possibility of going into a shooting war?
Yes, unfortunately I do. And people ask me about that possibility frequently, and we will restore liberty, and it's going to be either peaceful or violent. And the thing that will determine whether it is peaceful or violent is the number of people who have jumped on board and have kind of, you know, waken up. If we have lots and lots of people, if half the people in the United States stood up tomorrow and said enough is enough, then we would change the way government works. We would do it peacefully, and we would do it, you know, fairly rapidly. But if it takes a long time for people to wake up, and there are relatively few people, you know, to defend the idea of liberty, then it's necessarily going to be bloody, because the government still thinks that they can manipulate things using force. And the only way that you can resist force is with, you know, additional force. So I'm hoping that this change back towards liberty will be as peaceful as possible. I mean, that's why I've dedicated so much of my time to, you know, teaching the Constitution, explaining the fundamentals of the Constitution to as many people as will listen. And, you know, the goal, again, is to have so many people understand the basic issues that we have enough people to make the change to liberty peacefully. I don't want violence if we can at all avoid it.
Well, the big guns are coming out. If people listening to this broadcast right now will go to republicbroadcasting.org and take a look at the story. And it's you'll see the flash picture at the top of the page. It's a guy dressed in camo. Now, we've seen the MAKE report. You've seen a copy of that. You've seen what Napolitano has done with the DHS. There's a possibility that we're trying to radicalize vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. The newspapers were flooded. CNN was flooded yesterday with, we've got to do something about these homegrown terrorists. Now, you know what happened here? I am absolutely astounded. Here is the Southern Poverty Law Center, Morris Dees, and I read his divorce proceedings. I read the transcript of the divorce proceedings between his wife, Maureen, and Morris Dees. And it is absolutely shocking to me. This guy, and please, folks, understand that I don't run titillating sex scandalous stuff, but understand that I'm telling you this for a reason. Morris Dees, on an anniversary in the Watergate Hotel with his wife present, going to surprise her. He was going to have a menage a trois, bisexual menage a trois with another guy. This man, in these divorce proceedings, was revealed that he went after his stepdaughter, his minor stepdaughter, with sex toys. How sick and busted is this? And here's a guy that, along with the ADL and Southern Poverty Law, a good part of that information that was in that report that Janet Napolitano put out came directly from these unholy, twisted creatures, calling the right-wing extremists, the people like you, sir, myself, that are touting that here's the law, here's the Constitution. They're calling us right-wing extremists. They're calling us, Michael, terrorists.
Well, I'm in favor of liberty. Anybody who is opposed to liberty and is using government power and military force to destroy liberty is certainly not in my camp. And I will do everything that I can, you know, to restore liberty. When Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death," it's not because he was trying to come up with a clever bumper sticker. And until people understand that liberty is more important than life and death, because, you know, each of us is going to die eventually, but I want liberty to persist in this country forever. And until people understand that liberty is more important than life and death, and that they will actually stand up and fight for liberty, then it's not likely that we're going to have it. But again, we've been talking earlier about how people are waking up. They are being active. There are these town hall meetings where, you know, people are angry. you know, we have all the energy that we need. The question is, which direction is it going to flow?
Well, we were having brunch a little bit earlier today, and this was some of the topic of conversation down on one of my favorite greasy spoons, the Waffle House. That was an unpaid endorsement, by the way. But we were sitting there, and we were talking about this subject matter. And just literally a few feet from us, it looked like Army personnel. I'm assuming they were security. They were driving vehicles, Air Force vehicles. And we're right next to Tinker Air Force Base. And every once in a while, during our conversation, I would see the one guy take a break from his eggs and ham and take a look in our direction. These are the people that were also named in this report, coming out of Southern Poverty Law, the Oath Keepers. Now, here's a group, an organization, active military, law enforcement, retirees, that are banding together to say, look, if martial law is declared for whatever reason, social, financial collapse, you know, swine flu, whatever, if these people go against the American people, there's a good indication that a lot of them are not. But these are going to be the people because of this fusion between military, law enforcement, that they're there to share information. I mean, my God, they've thrown out, Michael, the Posse Comitatus, and they're now bringing in to the United States the forces to maybe and possibly go against the people. I just saw a thing on CNN. We only have a few minutes left here. I saw a thing on CNN where next week they're going to run a five-day series about fighting terrorism here at home. And you know what's going to be on the tail end of this one? It's going to be the DHS report, all the propaganda that's been gathered to try to shut down the dissenters or possible terrorists because they want their country back. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I forget who said it, but, you know, in times of tyranny, the person speaking the truth is, usually labeled a terrorist. So, you know, the best that we can do is get the ideas of freedom and liberty out there and to, approach our fellow Americans to join us. The clash of ideas is happening. I hope there is no clash of weapons, but, you know, the best I can do is to present these ideas and hope for the best.
Well, you've been running at Mach 3 with your hair on fire. You've been going all over the country holding your classes, constitutional classes. There's a lot of people putting a lot of time and energy. And you're right. The succeeding generations, Michael Badnarik, it's what we do today that they're either going to reap the benefit of next week, next month, next year, or it will be our failing to give them a constitutional republic with safety, freedom, liberty, and economic freedoms in this country. Michael Badnarik, I appreciate you spending the time with me today, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, Michael. Folks, that'll do it for us today. Signing off here at Oklahoma City, down here at the Freedom 21. This is great, folks. Make sure you tune in. We're running the simulcast live feed for this. There's a lot of good guests coming up. Take part in it. Join. Get your energy flowing. We're not dead yet. With